Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to consider a case that could dramatically change how federal elections are conducted. At issue, a fringe legal theory that would give state legislatures absolute authority to set rules for federal elections without any oversight from state courts. It's known as the independent state legislature theory. And legal scholars, including some Republicans, say the case could deliver a body blow to American democracy. The theory is driving a case from North Carolina. That's where the state Supreme Court rejected a gerrymandered congressional redistricting map drawn up by the Republican-controlled legislature. The state Supreme Court said the hyperpartisan map violated the state constitution, but GOP lawmakers appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that under this independent state legislature theory, they and they alone have the authority to alter redistricting plans. Now, a number of observers say that if the high court's conservative majority agrees, and there are hints that it might, it could provide a pathway to subvert election results. This hour On Point, how the latest threat to American democracy could come from North Carolina and the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's begin this hour with Professor Bertrall Ross. He's Justice Thurgood Marshall, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. Bertrall Ross, great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Anthony. It's great to be back.
I wonder if we could just explain a little more about the background of this case. I tried to give a thumbnail sketch there, but what more would you add to sort of explain how we got where we are today?
Sure, sure. It starts with the provision in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, which says the time, place, and manner of holding elections for U.S. senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. The provision goes on to say that Congress may alter such regulations if it so chooses. Now, how we got there, it started with the case that came out of Arizona about a half decade ago, in which there was a challenge to independent redistricting commissions. And the argument that was put forth by Arizona Republicans was that independent redistricting commissions cannot draw district lines, only the legislature could. Now, the court rejected that theory under the Article 1 time, place, and manner provision, finding that the people who ultimately adopted the independent redistricting commission through a referendum did have the power to delegate authority to an independent redistricting commission to draw district lines. Mm-hmm. Now, this theory is returning to the court right now in the context of redistricting challenge. In this case, it was the state court that got involved, as it has gotten involved in many other cases, in invalidating the district lines and then ultimately adopting a map that was chosen by its special masters.
I see. So I want to just try to understand this really clearly about where this independent state legislative theory comes from. And it stems, as you said, from the election clause in Article 1 of the Constitution. And I just want to read this language carefully because, I'll just read it. The times, place, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. So, to an untrained ear like mine, that sounds like the plaintiffs have a case here, that the Constitution gives all the power to the state legislature. Why isn't that the case?
Right. It's a deceptively appealing theory.
Yeah.
But it's a theory that is not consistent with past practice.
Got it.
First of all, past practice, the state courts have been heavily involved in reviewing redistricting practices by state legislatures. Second of all, the Constitution is full of provisions, the U.S. Constitution in particular, is full of provisions that delegate to one branch or the other certain powers. For example, Article 1 of the Constitution says that Congress shall regulate commerce between the states. But implied within those powers is the notion that the courts can review what the legislature does. That is the doctrine of judicial review. Judicial review has been said to be a critical feature of our system of checks and balances that exists within the federal constitution, and it also has existed since the founding of this nation within state constitutions. So it would be a pretty far-reaching finding for the court to ultimately determine that the state legislature has exclusive authority in this area, that the court cannot exercise its authority of judicial review, that it practices over every case on matters for which the state legislature is said to have authority under the state constitution or federal constitution. So that's what makes it a theory that is rather far-reaching and inconsistent with past doctrine.
I see. So the North Carolina Supreme Court rejected the argument that it didn't have the authority to review the actions of the state legislature. It said that that would be, quote, repugnant to the sovereignty of states, the authority of state constitutions, and the independence of state courts, and would produce absurd and dangerous consequences. What were they referring to there by absurd and dangerous consequences?
Well, here's the absurd and dangerous consequence that arises. What you would, if the court ultimately determines that the state legislature has exclusive authority over state courts with respect to time, place, and manner of holding elections, it would essentially say that the state legislature, in their decisions, trump the state constitution. They would trump provisions in state constitutions that provide for fair and free elections. They would trump, the state legislature would trump provisions in the constitution that provide for free speech and free assembly insofar as it impacts elections. They would trump the state legislature any constitutional provision that provides for non-discrimination in voting. Because essentially what the legislature would say under the independent state legislature doctrine is that we have all authority over this matter. You, the court, cannot intervene to protect any of these rights contained in the state constitution. That would be pretty absurd and would have far-reaching results.
So what do we know about how the U.S. Supreme Court justices might rule on this? As ever, it will come down to the conservative majority, and I gather that four of them, at least, have already expressed some, if not support, at least a willingness to take this on and consider it. Is that right?
Right. In terms of accepting the petition for the writ of certiorari, four justices have to agree to accept that petition. Right. So at least four justices have interest in reviewing this case. It doesn't necessarily dictate or indicate how they rule in this case, but they think it's enough of an issue or enough of a controversy for the Supreme Court to get involved. Mm-hmm. What we know in terms of the justices and their views on this matter is pretty little. We have the Arizona case, but that's a different case insofar as it involves the people of the state by referendum adopting an independent redistricting commission. Here we have the question of whether the state courts can be involved in redistricting matters insofar as they review state legislatures' practices in this area. All we have as indicators, because the court now is very different from the court that decided the Arizona case, is Justice Roberts, who has suggested that the legislature should have primary authority in this area. He didn't say to the exclusion of state courts, but perhaps that could be an indicator that he would potentially support this theory. But then again, we have the case of Rucho that was decided a couple years ago, in which the court said that they will not be involved, the Supreme Court said that they would not get involved in partisan gerrymandering, but that state courts and Congress can resolve and remedy any extreme forms of partisan gerrymandering. So in that case, the court suggests that state courts do have a role to play. All we know in terms of other Supreme Court decisions, such as the abortion decision of Dobbs, is that there are court justices on the court willing to take a very literalist interpretation of the Constitution. So insofar as Article 1, Section 4 doesn't say anything about courts, maybe that would be a reason for those who take on a more literalist interpretation to argue in favor or to find in favor of the independent state legislature doctrine.
Right. And if they found in favor, you mentioned sort of the consequences of that. I mean, among them, protections against partisan gerrymandering established through state courts could be overwritten. Independent redistricting commissions could be gutted. And here's what the Brennan Center wrote. The nightmare scenario is that the legislature, displeased with how an election official on the ground has interpreted her state's election laws, would invoke the theory as a pretext to refuse to certify the results of a presidential election and instead select its own slate of electors. How likely is that? I mean, is that a little bit Chicken Little, the sky is falling, or is there a real possibility of that, do you believe?
I do think that there's reason to be alarmed. There are many similarities between the Elections Clause, Article 1, Section 4, and the Article 2 Electors Clause, which is a provision that provides for the selection of electors in the Electoral College for presidential elections. So insofar as the court finds that the legislature has exclusive authority or authority exclusive of the state courts with respect to election clause matters, then potentially it could say the same thing with respect to the selection of presidential electors. And if it does decide to say the same thing, then you do have a scenario in which the state legislature can send to Congress a slate of electors that's inconsistent with the will of the people. And the court, state courts in particular, unable to intervene in these matters. So there are potentially a great number of risks that are associated with the court's adoption of the independent state legislature doctrine.
Aren't there, though, federal constitutional protections that would prevent a legislature from simply ignoring the will of the people?
In the Constitution itself, there isn't anything other than provisions that provide for the Republican form of government, but that provision has not been adjudicated or found justiciable by the Supreme Court. The court hasn't intervened to require that states maintain a Republican form of government. There are provisions in the Equal Protection Clause, but the court has been reluctant to interpret and apply that in a way to resolve election disputes. It did so in 2000, of course, with the Bush v. Gore case, but it stated clearly that that is a case for or an issue for one case only or a decision for one case only. So there aren't a ton of protections, surprisingly, for legislators ultimately deciding to send an issue or a slate of electors or to resolve an election dispute in favor of a minority over a majority that the court has been willing to invoke and to apply.
Right. Now, given that Republicans control 30 state legislatures, Democrats just 17, a decision in favor of the North Carolina legislatures would represent a big political win for Republicans at this moment, given the way political power is distributed across the country, right?
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that there's a reason why you see a Republican legislature bringing this theory forward. This is a time in which Republicans control most state legislatures. It's a time for Republicans to potentially entrench themselves in power. And what's the best way for Republicans to entrench themselves in power? Well, it's to engage in gerrymandering. Gerrymandering that provides for safe districts and for partisan advantage.
All right. Professor Bertrand Ross from the University of Virginia School of Law, stay with us. We're going to talk more about this, including hearing from somebody with a lot of authority who believes in the idea of independent state legislative theory. That's coming up after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today we're talking about the independent state legislature theory and a case from North Carolina Republicans before the U.S. Supreme Court. A number of scholars and activists warn it could deliver a catastrophic body blow to our democracy. I'm joined by Bertrand Ross, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. And joining us now is Dallas Woodhouse. He's the former executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party. He's now based in South Carolina, but writes a column for the John Locke Society, a North Carolina conservative think tank. And Dallas Woodhouse, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
So tell me why you support the position of North Carolina's Republicans in this case and why the independent legislative theory makes sense to you.
Well, I think a couple of things. I think a literal reading of the Constitution has some validity. But I also think there are very narrow grounds, not this big expansive view that the theory can have merit. And a couple of things I just want to point out based on some of your previous contents. It is simply not true that this would remove all checks on state legislatures. With specific to redistricting, the federal courts would continue to have a check. And of course, redistricting, and I'm going to talk more about this in a moment, redistricting is unique in that it has a direct override check by Congress written in the U.S. Constitution. I think most people, even some very well-respected left-leaning law professors, have debunked this idea that this theory could allow for the appointment of alternative electors, because Congress still sets the date for the selection of electors. I mean, as your listeners know, you know, there's no constitutional right to vote for president. You know, although we do, if a state wanted to appoint its own electors, as long as they decided to do so well before the election period and put it into law, they could do so. Now, no state's going to ever do that. And so this,
so you're saying the concern Bertrand Ross just laid out, some of the concerns, you're saying this is a little bit overblown or overblown?
Yeah, I do so. I do so. Cause you know, what happened in North Carolina, in my opinion, was a really egregious actions by the, North Carolina Supreme Court, a Democrat majority against the Republican legislature. And I'll just run through a couple of quick points on that. One is that the North Carolina Constitution is silent about political considerations in district drawing. Now, the court, you know, picked some flowery language and they just made this up. But you know, there is nothing on point in North Carolina's Constitution. I challenge readers to pick it up and read it. Really, the only point in redistricting in North Carolina is that the governor doesn't have a say in it, that it is exclusively the purview of the legislature, at least against the executive.
Right. But does that mean, just to be clear, Mr. Woodhouse, because I want to understand, but you're maintaining, and the case is maintaining, if I have this correct, that the North Carolina Supreme Court doesn't have the authority to review actions by the state legislature. Isn't that what you're maintaining?
So I think I would see it on a little more narrow grounds. Okay. I think it is basically this: when it is a jump ball, when it is a tie in football, the tie goes to the receiver. When it is a tie in situations like this, it goes to the legislature. And I think it's important to remember what the Supreme Court did here. Mm-hmm. That they didn't stop any kind of gerrymandering. They just picked their gerrymander over another one. And when the legislature came back and they did a redraw, they came up with an enormously competitive congressional map. It would have had four of North Carolina's 14 seats as highly competitive. Either party could have won a majority. And the court struck that down, and they basically came up with a requirement for a proportional election outcome. In other words, you have to draw the districts so they will reflect what previous statewide elections have been. It's a very dangerous precedent. I think what you will find is that if there is no mention in the state constitution of redistricting, and that should a court act like North Carolina did and refuse to approve the districts, refuse to do the redraw, refuse to give the legislature clear directions on how to correct the measure, and then impose districts on yourself, that goes too far, and it encroaches on some inherent power the legislature has.
Got it. So it goes too far. But I just want to read you this one. And I brought this up with Bertrand Ross, and I just like to get you to respond to this. So in rejecting the argument, the North Carolina Supreme Court, in rejecting the argument that it didn't have the authority to do what it did, it made this rather dramatic claim that would be repugnant to the sovereignty of states, the authority of state constitutions, and the independence of state courts, and would produce, they say, absurd and dangerous consequences. So the court is arguing that this essentially strikes at the heart of federalism, which sounds like a bedrock Republican value. And I'd like you to respond to that, because in a way, this really is taking striking at the heart of state control of state matters, if you look at it in a certain way.
Well, but it's not solely a state matter. It's a federal matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a federal matter of drawing federal congressional districts,
right,
or rules dealing with federal elections. I think you expect any court, like a Supreme Court, full of partisan Democrats, to sit there and defend their right to make a decision in a case they're getting ready to make, which is what they did. But I simply don't agree. I can understand the concerns of some people. I think that they, you know, take this to a wide perch that the court is unlikely to do. I think if they find for the independent legislative theory, I think they will find it on very narrow grounds, and I think it will be mostly limited to redistricting. You know, some of these other things that could possibly happen do take care of themselves in the political process. I mean, for example, you know, could you really have a state like North Carolina where the courts have blocked voter ID, where the legislature put in voter ID for federal elections and not state elections? You know, that would come up. That would create other problems with due process and you know, and the two parties would have to get together and figure it out, because neither one would want to give their voters two different ballots. I mean, there are practical implications that would stop a lot of these worst case scenarios that some people have brought up.
Right. What I'd love you to respond, Mr. Woodhouse, to the concerns of some legal scholars, including Republicans like former federal appeals court judge Michael Luttig. He was quoted in the New York Times as saying this: the Supreme Court's decision will be enormously significant for presidential elections, congressional elections, and congressional districting, and therefore for American democracy in general. So even people like J. Michael Luttig have big concerns about this. What would you say to him to, you know, relieve some of his concerns?
Well, I would say, number one, that it doesn't necessarily mean that the significance will be bad. I mean, I think we have reached an untenable situation with district drawing. I mean, your previous guest referred to the Rucho case. That's a case out of North Carolina. We can just go down, you know, case after case after case that has gone to the U.S. Supreme Court in dealing with district drawing. We have to bring some sanity back to the process and give somebody authority to actually draw districts in America, even when other people don't like the outcome. I think I see very little implication to it about a presidential election. You could use this theory to make part of your argument, but then you have multiple other hurdles to get over. And then there's the practicality of this, right? Let's just remember that with all the talk about Donald Trump and all he did and what he tried to do, the system worked, right? Well, Joe Biden's the president of the United States right now.
Yeah, but that certainly, Joe Biden is the president of the United States, notwithstanding efforts by Donald Trump to, well, you know, a lot of people make a pretty strong case, and we're hearing a lot in these January 6th hearings that he did a lot to try to subvert that election. And I guess
In 2016, right, multiple Democrats voted against the certification of the election, which is their right under the Constitution. My point is that these processes, you know, work. I mean, I don't think we ought to jump to the worst case scenario when we just saw the system tested in a pretty dramatic way and it worked.
Right. But I guess the critics, Mr. Woodhouse, would say, yes, the process held together in 2020, no question. But a case like this, if it decides in favor of this theory, this independent state legislature theory, that the process might not work the next time. I think that's the concern that the critics have. And let me bring Birchall Ross back in, because I know he's been listening. Birchall Ross, I mean, Mr. Woodhouse has made a lot of points, including that the process worked and there's no reason to believe that it wouldn't work going forward. What's your response to that?
I'm not sure the process is actually working. What we're seeing are pretty extreme forms of gerrymandering, and we're seeing courts, state courts, imposing the limited checks that they can impose. To say that the constitutions don't say anything about redistricting. They actually do. In North Carolina's constitution says, provides for fair and free elections, which I think relates directly to concerns about redistricting.
You,
excuse me, sir. Can I finish?
Let Mr. Ross just finish, Mr. Woodhouse. Then we'll come back to you.
Okay. Thank you. And so there are provisions that provide for fair and free elections that are designed to for the courts to intervene and review what state legislatures have done. Now, we can't say we have the federal courts to rely on because the federal courts have opted out of redistricting in the Rucho case. The court, Supreme Court clearly says that this is not a matter for federal courts to address. And so we're left with Congress. Now, Congress is comprised of the same partisan actors that state legislatures are comprised of. Do we imagine that Congress, a Republican-controlled Congress, will step in to stop Republicans from drawing districts that are favorable to Republican Congress members? I think that that's highly unlikely. And so we're left to state courts. And if we see this independent state legislature doctrine or theory embraced by the court, state courts are no longer available to stop the madness of this extreme form of gerrymandering that's distorting our democracies in very problematic ways.
Right.
All right. Let me jump in there, please, real quick.
Yeah. And Mr. Woodhouse, I'm going to let you jump in, but I just do want to make a point about gerrymandering. And I just want to read a comment from Bill Kenter on Facebook, one of our listeners. Both parties use this tactic in every state they control. Both parties don't care about democracy. People talk like Republicans are the only ones who do it, meaning gerrymandering. I live in Illinois. They sprawl Democratic strongholds across huge swaths of rural areas. So I just want to get that point out there, Mr. Woodhouse, that no one is saying that Republicans alone are responsible for gerrymandering. But go ahead, make your point.
So a couple of things here. I sort of believe that the term gerrymandering has really stopped to mean anything. It's used so broadly. I mean, you know, it used to mean, you know, back in the salamander district, you know, people drawing districts in, you know, really bizarre shapes and other things. Now it just seems to mean whatever it means to somebody who doesn't like the election outcome. Number two, I think there's this attitude that so the federal court, and by the way, the professor is just wrong that the Rucho case says that the federal courts have no role in redistricting review. They have no rule. They said it is not a judiciable matter when it comes to partisan or gerrymandering, but the federal courts continue to police one man, one vote, equal population, racial gerrymandering, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Certainly check on there. Number two, the fact that some people don't like the outcome. In other words, you don't like what the U.S. Supreme Court said in the Rucho case, and you don't think that Congress will provide a significant check, doesn't in itself empower state courts to do what they are doing.
All right. Right? Well, Mr. Woodhouse, stop right there, because I want to ask Birchall Ross to come back to that point that you made, and you made it a couple of times, Birchall Ross, that federal courts would be in a position to continue to impose certain checks and balances here if the Supreme Court found in favor of the independent state legislature theory.
I mean, I think that the commentators said it right. The court has said that they will not be involved in partisan gerrymandering. The North Carolina case is about partisan gerrymandering. If the federal courts have opted out of this issue, then they will not review or check partisan gerrymandering. One person, one vote is not a check on partisan gerrymandering. The Voting Rights Act is not a check on partisan gerrymandering. Racial gerrymandering doctrine is not a check on partisan gerrymandering. And partisan gerrymandering is extraordinarily distortive in such a way that the trial court, with respect to the North Carolina map, said that the map was more advantageous to Republicans than 99.9999% of neutral maps. That is an extreme form of partisan gerrymandering that would go essentially unchecked if the independent state legislature theory is accepted.
What do you think, Dallas Woodhouse?
The voters are the ultimate check on district drawing, and that's how the Constitution sets it up. And I think, quite frankly, I think all of these efforts on quote-unquote partisan gerrymandering are a way for the left to try to compensate the Democrat Party for a geographic and political problem that they have. And by the way, North Carolina is a microcosm of the country in this, where Democrats are fairly competitive in statewide races. They've elected the governor the last two times. But the fact is their voters are enormously concentrated in a handful of North Carolina's 100 counties. In 2016, Donald Trump won the presidency in North Carolina by winning 76 of North Carolina's 100 counties. But the Democrat governor won election by winning 28 of North Carolina's counties. So less than a third of North Carolina's counties was able to bring them to statewide victory. But that math just doesn't play out into district drawing. And so they are scrambling through the Rucho case, through other cases, through state courts to find a way to compensate the Democrats for a geographic and political problem where their voters are highly concentrated into a select few urban areas.
Well, we should note, though, that state courts have weighed in on congressional redistricting following the 2020 census on both sides. I mean, judges have rejected Republican gerrymanders in North Carolina, as we've been discussing, in Pennsylvania. They've also rejected maps drawn by Democrats, Democratic-led legislatures in states like New York and Maryland. So it does go both ways here. But Dallas Woodhouse, former executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party, he's also a columnist for the John Locke Foundation, a conservative North Carolina think tank, and executive director of the South Carolina Policy Council. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. And Birchall Ross, he's the Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law at University of Virginia Law School. Stick with us. We're going to take on another side of this conversation after the break. We're talking about Moore versus Harper, a case before the Supreme Court, which tests the legal theory known as the independent legislature theory. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about Moore versus Harper, a case before the Supreme Court, which tests the legal theory known as the independent state legislature theory. With me is Birchall Ross, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. And joining me now is Dan Vicuña. He's National Redistricting Manager at the nonpartisan voting rights group Common Cause. Common Cause was one of the plaintiffs that challenged the redistricting map before the North Carolina Supreme Court. Dan Vicuña, welcome. It's good to have you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So what's your case against the independent legislative theory and, as it's being considered by the Supreme Court right now?
Well, our view is that state courts play an absolutely essential role in protecting the rule of law. I mean, congressional maps should absolutely be drawn with voting rights in mind, with the protections that state constitutions and state law provides being adhered to. And, you know, the idea that state courts are supposed to give a free pass to legislators to manipulate our voting districts in clear violation of state constitutions is absurd on its face and undemocratic.
We heard Dallas Woodhouse making a case that there was, he described a sort of case of judicial overreach from the North Carolina Supreme Court, not just that it had a problem that about a gerrymandered redistricting process, but that it wanted to substitute one, in his opinion, one sort of hyper-partisan map for their own hyper-partisan map. Respond to that concern.
Yeah, I mean, it begs the question, what's the purpose of having state courts? I mean, if they're supposed to sit on the sidelines and allow manipulation of districts to occur and do nothing, I don't really understand what's the purpose of state constitutions and state courts. Obviously, they are meant to do their job and protect voters from partisan overreach of legislatures and the manipulation of democracy. North Carolina very clearly cracked and packed Democratic voters, discriminated against them for the purposes of maximizing the number of Republican seats, making it incredibly difficult for Democratic voters to translate their votes into seats. And they came back with minimal tweaks that, you know, they believed that their role was, not to completely redo the map. I think there's an argument to be made that they can, in fact, throw out an old junk map and do it from scratch. But they decided that they would just sort of tweak a little bit on the edges to ensure that North Carolina's congressional map adhere to the North Carolina Constitution. And that seems like an incredibly important, essential role for state courts to play in the redistricting process.
I'd like to sort of ask you where you are on the big sort of fear question about this, what the Brennan Center calls the nightmare scenario, that the results for that this could sort of provide a roadmap, essentially, for the state's electors to be substituted by electors chosen by the legislature. Do you think it's that dire? Is that where this could end up?
I mean, I think at this point we don't know. I mean, I think if this case goes the wrong way, it would of course be devastating just for redistricting. And which would be certainly bad enough, right? Calling into question the constitutionality of incredibly important reforms that states have implemented to take the process out of the hands of partisan legislators and give it to independent bodies to try alternative, nonpartisan, open processes for drawing districts. Beyond that, you've got certainly a fear of what how state courts can provide oversight in other areas, such as vote by mail restrictions, removal of early voting opportunities, even the secret ballot, and whether that even extends to something as sort of scary as undermining the popular vote of a state legislature, determining that they'll just appoint whichever electors determine whichever presidential victor they want to. It's on the table, and it certainly makes me nervous.
Right. Birchall Ross, I want to come back to you with just a very basic question, getting back to the language in the Constitution. I mean, I know you've talked eloquently about Supreme Court precedents that favor the case against the independent state legislative theory. But I'm just curious why the framers of the Constitution would have used this language. The time, place, and manner of holding elections shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And is this an issue of what they actually meant by legislature? In other words, did they actually mean the legislative body, or did they mean the legislative process that includes the legislative body, the governor, the courts?
Right. Going back to the history, and this is where history can be inconclusive, the framers didn't really discuss the issue of the legislature versus the courts versus the states. What they were trying to do with Article 1, Section 4 is demarcate a division of authority between the state legislatures and Congress. Mm-hmm. So it's really a matter of federalism. And what the state legislatures or the states were arguing at the time is that these matters over elections should be left to us. And being left to us means being left to legislatures who had authority with respect to a variety of election matters. But their authority over election matters did not preclude the courts or the Constitution from overriding what the legislature wants. For example, in the early state constitutions, the districts were established in the Constitution itself. The Constitution itself will say which counties were in which districts. It certainly would be very odd for the state legislature to have the power to override what the Constitution specifically says about which states, which counties, which should be in which districts. So that suggests to me that there is a clear understanding, even at the founding era, that the Constitution and what it says would trump essentially what the state legislature says and does with respect to the time, place, and manner of elections. And the responsibility of courts is to enforce the Constitution. And that's where courts come in. So that's what we know in terms of the framing and founding era.
All right, I want to read a comment from another listener on Facebook. Aaron Palicki writes this: "You can be sure that when the four," and by that we're referring to the four Supreme Court justices who have who are interested in hearing this case, who like this theory, write their opinions, there will be no reference to the long history of doing it another way. They will completely ignore history in order to rule for their preferred result. The Supreme Court has become a totally political body that twists itself into knots to rule the way they want. What they want is to allow Republican legislatures to overrule the voters by saying there was fraud and thus change the results the voters want into a result Republicans want. It's an extremely anti-democratic result. So that's from Aaron Palicki writing on Facebook. Birchall Ross, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the possible outcomes of a Supreme Court decision. Can you game those out for us? In other words,
sure.
It might be a subtle rejection or a subtle embrace of independent state legislative theory or some point in between. What are the possible results?
Right. I see three main possibilities, and there is perhaps some in between. One is that they reject the independent state legislature theory, and we go on as before, which the state courts are involved in reviewing what state legislatures do with respect to districting and other matters. The second result would be a complete acceptance of the independent state legislature theory, which would exclude courts from reviewing anything state legislatures do with respect to gerrymandering or other matters. And I don't think, I think that Dallas tried to draw a distinction between districting and other matters, but if the court decides that districting is a time, place, and manner of elections, it's hard to preclude other forms of election rules from that decision. So then there's the in-between matter, and this is where you could have compromise, but it's not necessarily a compromise that I see as sustainable. And they could rule that, yes, the courts can play a role, state courts can play a role in invalidating or reviewing state legislative or the drawing of district lines, but they cannot involve themselves in drawing district lines. They can't, as they did in the North Carolina case, appoint special masters to draw a different set of district lines and to impose them on an election. Now, the problem with taking away that power from the court is, well, what happens if the state legislature draws a district line, draws a map that the court finds unconstitutional? What map governs? And it's not clear what would happen in that case, because the old map would be a malapportioned map because it would not have equal population. The new map would have been declared unconstitutional, and you've taken away the power of the court to draw a map that would be constitutional. Mm. So it would create all kinds of gridlock for which there's no clear resolution. So I think the in-between opportunity might seem appealing and likely would raise all kinds of problems.
Dan Vicuña, I'd love you to chime in. What do you see as the sort of possible outcomes that you would add to what Birchall Ross said?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's about right. I mean, it is illogical for the idea that the court would, you know, try to split the baby. I mean, the plaintiffs here are seeking a state legislature sort of total autonomy, total authority over the conduct of federal elections, which would have absolutely absurd consequences. I do have to respond to one thing that Mr. Woodhouse stated, that the voters are the ultimate check on gerrymandering or on redistricting. I mean, the very purpose of gerrymandering, and it's done to great effect, is to preordain the outcome of elections for an entire decade. And that's done with incredible scientific precision. So the notion that the voters can have some sort of effective impact to turn back gerrymandering, when the very purpose of the practice is to reduce their ability to hold legislators accountable for their actions, is just ridiculous.
Mm. Birchall Ross, if the court does rule in favor of the plaintiffs and upholds the principle of independent state legislature theory, are there steps that Congress could take to protect the guardrails of democracy to respond to a decision like this?
Absolutely. I mean, Congress has plenary authority over this matter. Article 1, Section 4 says that Congress may at any time by law make or alter regulations that the state legislature adopts. Now, the Democrats in Congress have proposed different forms of regulations of elections that would address unfairness in districting, that would potentially police gerrymandering. The problem, however, is that Congress, because of the partisan division and polarization, doesn't have the capacity right now to pass such a law that would check state legislatures. And going back to a comment I made earlier in this program that I may have spoke too quickly on, it's what the state legislatures are doing, it's important to be reminded, is drawing district lines for Congress members.
Right.
And they're drawing district lines for Congress members in a way that's favorable to the Congress members of their party. I think it's unlikely that those Congress members who stand to benefit from these drawing of district lines would be willing to, in a sense, override state legislatures and necessarily take this power away from state legislatures in ways that might impact their possibilities and probability of being elected in the next election. So there's a whole multiple layers of self-interest at issue that makes it hard to imagine that Congress would play a particularly active role in policing this practice of gerrymandering.
What about fixing the Electoral Count Act, which the January 6th insurrectionists tried to exploit to overturn the 2020 election? I mean, how important would that be right now? And I ask because, I mean, maybe it's a little bit off topic, but there seems to be some bipartisan appetite for that.
Right. There is an appetite for it, fixing the Electoral Count Act, fixing the ambiguities that are set forth in the Electoral Count Act with respect to the process that the House of Representatives has to go through in terms of counting these ballots. But what the Electoral Count Act and the reforms have not quite figured out how to address clearly is how to police state legislatures and the potentially nefarious practice of choosing an alternative slate of elections before the deadline that is set forth in the Electoral Count Act that's inconsistent with the will of the voters of the state. Now, the Electoral Count Act and its more far-reaching reform designs could perhaps reach this particular type of practice. But in the reforms that are being proposed to have bipartisan support, I worry that it will not police this potential threat to presidential elections.
Mm. Dan Vicuña, we're in the midst of congressional hearings about the January 6th insurrection, and we're hearing a pretty alarming case about efforts that were put in place to overturn a legitimate election by a sitting president and his supporters. It was a body blow to our electoral process and democratic system, but as Dallas Woodhouse said, the system did hold. But I'm wondering, are you worried that a case like this, if the independent state legislature theory is upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, that might be a blow from which our democracy does not survive?
I am incredibly worried. I think the idea that you watched what happened, how close we came to both sort of an overthrow of an election by violence and an attempt to do so sort of in the courts by former President Trump's attorneys making, spreading theories of the case that are almost as absurd or probably equally absurd as the independent state legislature theory. I think to point out that Joe Biden was elected president as some sort of ultimate proof that the system will hold, I think it doesn't make any sense. I mean, this provides a potential roadmap for the will of the voters to be thwarted in a way that will really turn back the tide of democracy in this country. So, I think it's a definite risk that we're concerned with.
Right. And Virgil Ross, the same question to you. Are you worried that a case like this, that it might deliver a blow that really could prove, I don't know, damaging in a way that democracy does not come back from?
Yeah, this country is in a position where it needs to be searching for reinforcements of checks and guardrails on our democracy to keep us on a path to maintaining our democracy. And removing the checks works in the opposite direction. Removing an important check, one of the last important checks that remains with respect to gerrymandering and potentially with respect to the counting of electoral votes for the president, would be very threatening to the future of our democracy. I don't want to be so pessimistic to say that politicians act completely without virtue, but I will say that virtue has taken a backseat to partisanship. And that partisanship is corrosive to our democracy. It leads to manipulation of elections, manipulations of district maps that is having a tremendous effect on the ability of the people to translate their will into representation. And that is the point of democracy, for the majority of the people to be able to translate its will into elections that are favorable to the majority and ultimately to results that are favorable to that majority.
All right. Well, that's Professor Virgil Ross. He's Justice Thurgood Marshall, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Dan Vicuña, National Redistricting Manager at Common Cause. Thank you for your time as well. I'm very grateful to have you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Listeners, stay with us. You can continue this conversation online. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.